Welcome to Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is Natalie S. Harnett, the author of The Hollow Ground, which won the 2015 John Gardner Fiction Book Award and the 2014 Appalachian Book of the Year Award. She's a native New Yorker who's been published in The MacGuffin, The Madison Review, and The New York Times, and it's a pleasure to have her on the show today. Natalie, welcome to Covered.
Thanks so much for having me here, Harry. I'm really excited to be talking with you.
Do you mind telling us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, sure. It's a coming-of-age story. It's part murder mystery, part family saga, and it's inspired by the coal mine fires that took place in Centralia and Carbondale, Pennsylvania. And it's about a young girl who goes into the abandoned mine shafts beneath her town, and she makes a very grisly discovery. And in the aftermath of that, many old secrets are uncovered that threaten to unhinge her entire family and even at times the community.
Do you have a portion of the book that you might be able to read?
Sure, I can read the prologue.
Excellent.
We walk on fire or air, so Daddy liked to say. Basement floors too hot to touch. Steaming green lawns in the dead of winter. Sinkholes quick and sudden. Plunging open at your feet. Where the hollowed out ground didn't burn, it collapsed or sank. Here is what's known as the anthracite coal region of Pennsylvania, fed by the largest vein of anthracite coal in the world. That coal was blasted, hauled, breathed, and swallowed by our daddy's daddy and by theirs before them. And when those mines shut down, those snaking black tunnels were left to flood, to shift. They were left to burn. Burning more than coal, I tell you. When I was still curled and wet in my ma's belly, those mines burned my memory. Burned me with the want to see them for myself, to enter their long, sloping darkness and know what my daddy went through before whatever it was that broke inside him. I'm not saying I knew what I'd uncover when I crawled and scraped my way into that narrow monkey shaft. I'm not saying I knew the secrets I freed from there would change us permanently for worse or better. I'm just saying that sometimes what we seek is something we hope with all our blood and bone we'll never find.
You know, your main character, Bridget Howley, has a very distinct voice. It's been likened to Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird. How did you come to create that voice? What did it take to craft that voice for the book?
It took me a really long time to get that voice. And this is the first time I'd ever written in first person. Everything else I'd ever written was in third person. So that was a really big shift for me too, to do first person. And it must have taken me at least 6 months to get this girl's voice. And, you know, I really struggled and thought I would never find her. But I was thinking very much of my mother and using her recollections from her childhood, not that she grew up with the coal mine fires, but she has very vivid memories from being the age of 11, 12, the age that Bridget is in the book. And I was also thinking of my grandfather's neighbors. Now, I grew up in Queens, but my grandfather lived in northeastern Pennsylvania, and I went there a lot from the time I was very young, and I had some close friends there. And I was thinking of a particular family from that area of northeastern Pennsylvania and the way they spoke. So I was thinking both of those things when I finally just, you know, hit on her voice. And once I had it, she could just, you know, write herself. Then I just couldn't stop her. And I really missed that voice. I loved writing with her.
The book takes place in the 1960s in these two fictional locations that are meant to stand in for Centralia and Carbondale, which have been, I believe Carbondale was one of, if not the first location of the anthracite coal mine.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then Centralia, which has gone from, I'd say, 1,000 people in 2010 to 10 people as of right now. What drew you to those locations to set the book in, and why the 1960s?
I originally just was starting a novel. I knew I wanted to do first person, and I knew I wanted to set it in Carbondale, Pennsylvania, just because that was a city that it always called to me as a kid. It's one of those towns, I'm sure we've all seen them, that you could just see that had once been a booming, thriving place, and whatever industry supported it shut down. And then you just see, you know, the empty storefront and the abandoned, beautiful homes. And that's what Carbondale looked like, you know, from my earliest recollection, probably in the late 70s and through the 80s. And I just thought, you know, I knew it was a coal mine town. And I thought, I want to tell the story of what happened to the coal mine towns after the coal mine shut down. And so that's all I knew, that I had this young girl, and I knew it would be a family story because I always write family stories. And I thought, I just want to tell what happened to these coal mine towns after the mine shut down. And then as I was writing, I remembered my grandfather's neighbor telling me about houses in Scranton where the floors were too hot to walk on from the fires burning beneath them. I thought, wow, you know, that is some image and metaphor, and I really should include that. But I want to tell the story of Carbondale. So I originally planned to have the family in a house in Scranton in the beginning of the book and move them to Carbondale. But as I started researching the Scranton coal mine fires, I found almost nothing on them. What I kept coming across was Centralia, which I had never heard of before. And once I started reading about it, I was, of course, you know, fascinated and drawn to it. And so, boy, you know, now I have to tell the story of this place. And so I thought, well, still, I want to tell the story of Carbondale. So I'll set it in a place like Centralia in the beginning, and then I'll move them to Carbondale. But as I was completing my research on the book, and I'd already written, you know, most of the draft of the book, but as I was completing the research, I discovered that Carbondale had had a tremendous fire on scale with the fire that took place in Centralia. And so then I ditched the whole draft of the book I had. I kept just those opening chapters that were based on Centralia, and I rewrote the rest of the book based on the fire that took place in Carbondale. So it was not, you know, a story that I initially planned on telling at all, those fires. I just happened across them.
What was the research process like? Did you visit Centralia at all?
I did go and visit Centralia, but most of the research, you know, now there is so much online. And in a way, that's lucky because there's actually so many people, especially from Centralia, but also from Carbondale, who have, you know, have their own blogs or have some sort of their own sites, some genealogical sites from people where then they just posted pictures of fire, you know, the fires that their family had lived through. And so I was able to get a lot of, personal type of research that otherwise would have been very difficult to come across, you know, if it wasn't for those opportunities online to see what people were posting. Otherwise, I did, you know, read some books about Centralia, and there was a small one recently published on the Carbondale fire, you know, and then otherwise the historical societies I got a lot of research from.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nacht Sound Engineering. Nacht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nacht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nacht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nacht Sound Engineering today at nachtsound.com. That's N-A-C-H-T sound.com. Nacht, more than a stack of tracks. Do you know if there's anyone who still lives there? I'm curious to know, you know, what's keeping them there?
In Centralia or Carbondale?
Oh, Centralia, sorry.
In Centralia, that is really a remarkable story. You know, for people who don't know, that fire started in the early 60s, and there were some attempts to put it out, but nothing, you know, nothing that was anywhere near aggressive enough to actually put it out. And by the 1980s, that fire was so extensive that the government just decided there was no way they could put it out. And they bought out the families, you know, who were living there. And almost all of those families relocated. But several of the families decided to stay. And then they sued the government. The government didn't want them to stay. Those people then sued the government to stay. They eventually did win that lawsuit. And they're there, you know, and why exactly they're there. I can't, you know, I haven't actually personally interviewed those particular people, but I have heard of, you know, a number of people who believe it was a conspiracy that the fire, yeah, there was a fire, but it's nowhere near as bad as people are saying. It's not as dangerous, that either the government or the coal companies wanted people to believe it was worse than it was so that the people would leave and then the government or the coal companies could get that coal, you know, much more easily. And that was the case in Carbondale, too. There were a lot of conspiracy theories like that. So exactly why the people who stayed in Centralia stayed, I can't say. You know, if they believed in that conspiracy, I'm guessing, but I don't really know. But I can't even imagine how difficult it must be staying there, because it was a really thriving community. You know, people who had been there for generations, everyone knew each other. And then to have all of those people and all of those homes gone, and for it to just be now overgrown wilderness with just these few houses there, you know, and the ground still smoking from this fire. And just people, many people probably aren't aware that fire is still burning, and they expect it to burn for another 250 years. So what it can be like living there, it must be so eerie and strange, and I would think so lonely.
That's amazing that they expect it to burn for so long.
Yes, and they actually think it's running out of fire, running out of coal beneath Centralia, and is moving towards Mount Carmel, which is a very large city.
Have they said how far they expect this to spread? I mean, is all of Pennsylvania in danger of?
Well, you know, now that you mentioned that, I don't have an exact number, but there are over 50 coal mine fires burning in Pennsylvania right now. In fact, there's one burning right outside of Carbondale again, and they're doing a huge, going to do a huge dig out to get rid of that fire. But every coal mine state has this issue, and any country that has coal mines has this issue. It's a huge, you know, environmental disaster that so many people don't know about.
In the back of the book, there are study materials for use in schools. Is the book being taught in schools as sort of an insight into what's going on in Pennsylvania?
I have worked, you know, very hard to spread the news to schools, as has Macmillan, which is the parent company of St. Martin Press, who published this book. They've brought it to many school conferences. I've had teachers tell me they're interested. I've had teachers tell me they were ordering the book, especially in colleges, and especially in Pennsylvania colleges, that they were ordering the books into literature classes and writing classes. But exactly who's ordered them and who's teaching them, like, this fall, I don't know. You know, I hope that people are, you know, making use of the book and at least finding out about the book. You know, that's been the biggest challenge, is just kind of spreading the word about it. But it certainly does have such an important story to tell, especially to Pennsylvania residents, but I think, you know, particularly to all of Appalachia. So I was especially honored to have the book win that Appalachian Book of the Year award. That was really touching for me and moving.
How long did it take you to write the book?
When someone asks me that, I usually say 4.5 years. I don't really know for sure. I had a baby in the middle of it, and that both, you know, made it so much harder to write and motivated me so much more to finish it. But I'd say that it was probably about 4.5 years.
In terms of the publication process, and I'm always interested, and I know a lot of my listeners are interested in, you know, what's the publication process like for you from the time you got the agent to holding the final book in your hands?
I had, you know, the publication process for me was probably well over, this is my first published novel, but my fourth written novel. And sometimes I say it's my fifth written novel, because I rewrote the other novel so many times. It's like, do you count that as a new novel or not? You know, I can't even say.
It's your ghost set of Watchmen.
Yes, right. And then I had, you know, I had an agent for a while, and I was working on a major rewrite of an earlier book with her. And while I was doing that, I got this email from her, which it was clearly a mass email she'd sent to, you know, many people, just announcing that she decided to no longer represent fiction. And so there I was, just afloat in the middle of this revision, you know, now with no agent. So it was a very long process just in terms of even getting the agent, you know, and then once I got the agent, he's an excellent, excellent reader of my work, and that I'm so grateful for, you know, and I'm not sure that every agent really is such a great reader, but he's really a wonderful reader for me. And so we worked on some revisions of The Hollow Ground. And then I was just very lucky that the way agents usually sell books is they have, you know, a series of lists and they hit what they consider the top publishers first. Then they, you know, wait for responses. If no one's interested, they move to like the second tier of publishers and then, you know, so on and so on from there. And I was just very lucky that it sold, you know, in that first push. And that was incredibly exciting. And I thought, wow, oh my God, you know, here I am. I've got this book now going to be coming out. But then it took 2 years from the time it sells to actually be out in bookstores. And mine was probably just under 2 years. I've since learned, you know, books can take even longer than 2 years from the time they sell. So it's a very long, you know, and by and large, slow process. You know, wonderful. It's been a dream come true. But I mean, that's the part I didn't know, you know, so it's been a real learning process for me in terms of the publishing world and the publicity that the author is required to do nowadays.
That's interesting about the marketing and the everything that you're supposed to be doing on your side, because, you know, when you talk to people who have self-published or published with an independent press, they talk about how, you know, all of the marketing is on them. They're responsible for all the social media, paying for ads or doing blog exchanges, all of these things to help get the word of the book out. But people who traditionally publish or who are looking to traditionally publish, yours truly included, have sort of come to expect the publisher will handle that aspect of it. But I guess that's not true in all cases.
Unfortunately, that's pretty unrealistic. It does happen. You know, if you're incredibly lucky, it does happen. And, you know, that's the thing is, it's the publisher who's taking you, or they taking you on, and you're going to be one of their lead titles, meaning they are going to put in all their effort, you know, all their marketing effort. They are going to really push this book. And that's, you know, they have books that they decide to do that with. And if you are so fortunate, then believe me, you'll still need to do a lot of your own publicity, but they will do a tremendous amount for you. But otherwise, you know, most of the people getting published need to make their own, you know, their own publicity campaigns. And that's not to say that the publisher doesn't help. I mean, it's still having one of the, you know, major large publishers is a big help just in terms of having their name behind you. And, you know, and there are many different things that they do, but still most of the marketing has been on me. And that is true for every other debut author that I have met during this process. And I've met, you know, quite a number of them. And every one of them, the ones who have gotten very large press, you know, media press, they got it from their own contact. I don't know anybody yet who I've met who the publisher got it for them.
Now, have you done any touring or any travel to get the book out?
I did. And, you know, believe it or not, the publishers now, they really don't push that. They don't recommend it. They even kind of basically told me not to do it. They don't see a connection between doing events and book sales. And that is most likely true. But are book events worth it? I think so. And every other author, you know, who's been recently published, who I've spoken to also thinks so. And it's just about, you know, getting the word out there, talking to people. You never know then who knows who, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, that's what you're doing is networking at those events. So I did. I just wound up kind of initially having a book launch both in Pennsylvania and on Long Island. And then, you know, just as you meet people, you get invited to something else. And so I just found that one event led to another. And so I'm still actually doing a book tour, even though the book came out in May of 2014. I've been doing events fairly steady since. And it's just because, you know, the word spreads and one thing leads to another. And so I find them to be very worthwhile, even though, of course, they are quite time consuming and can be expensive because you're often not getting paid for these events or even getting travel expenses for these events. But it is something, you know, if there are any aspiring authors out there or debut authors, I would strongly recommend that they try and do as many events as they possibly can.
As much as it is about the book, it's also about educating people about what's going on in Pennsylvania. I liken it to Don Winslow doing interviews about the drug cartels in Mexico. With all of the research that you've done on the mine fires and that he's done on the what goes on with the cartels down there, you know, you become an expert now.
Yeah. You know, that I think that is part of why I keep getting these invites, is because now I do have a PowerPoint slideshow that I do. And people are, you know, people are just blown away because most people have not heard of these fires. And there's so many of them. And the consequences from, you know, of them are just unbelievable. Just to mention them, you know, to some of the listeners, it's poison gases coming into your home. That's actually the biggest threat. So people would have to leave their windows open in any kind of weather, you know, raining, freezing, snowing, just to vent the houses. Subsistence, where they'd have to keep propping up the house. As I mentioned, the floors being too hot to walk on. In some cases, the basement floors would be so hot, they turn the soles of people's shoes gummy. The sidewalks would be too hot for dogs to walk on. And then, of course, there's sinkholes. And I've just heard of more and more, as I've done these events, there is almost always, and I've done events in Rhode Island and Texas, you know, all different places, almost always there is someone from Coal Region, Pennsylvania, who then tells me a story that, you know, blows me away. And one I just recently, she remembered this happened in the 70s, where an entire house disappeared into a sinkhole. And this was in sort of around the Wilkes-Barre area of Pennsylvania. So, I mean, I think I have become this sort of spokesperson of these fires, which, you know, again, like I said, it's not like I intended to write about these fires, but I am kind of honored to be in the position to be, you know, telling people about this incredible economic and environmental, you know, ongoing disaster that very few people know about.
Have any lawsuits been levied at the companies behind the mining itself or the government for allowing?
You know, not that I'm aware of. And I mean, there certainly could be, but not that I've seen. But often these companies are funding the dig outs, or in whatever way they're attempting to put out these fires, are often the companies are taxed by the government. And it's those taxes that they pay that are funding a large part of the dig outs, or in whatever way they're attempting to get rid of the fire.
Today's episode is brought to you by FeedPress, a simple, intuitive, and powerful RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform. FeedPress is made for bloggers and podcasters. Featuring powerful subscriber and podcast download tracking, integrated newsletters, automated publishing to popular social networks such as Twitter and Facebook, a slick drag-and-drop podcast hosting interface, and everything you need in order to submit an optimized feed to iTunes. With 250 megabytes of flexible file storage that rolls over monthly, you can easily upload 4 episodes per month. Upgrading storage is easy and affordable, starting at a flat rate of just $20 for 1 gigabyte. Let's face it, you've probably thought about moving from the aging feed burner. FeedPress offers an automatic migration tool so you can make that transition with ease. Answer a few simple questions and the rest is taken care of. Your feeds and subscriber data will be transitioned into your FeedPress account, leaving you free to focus on what you do best, making content. Now is the perfect time to have all of your analytics and podcast hosting in a beautiful and unified dashboard. FeedPress offers free migration assistance and will take care of the hard work for you. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via email. Get in touch and they can help. FeedPress now serves more than 30 million requests per month and is trusted by such popular blogs and podcasting networks as ESN, Mule Radio, Unprofessional, The New Disruptors, Beautiful Pixels, Inessential, MacGasm, The Brooks Review, 512 Pixels, and of course, Covered. Sign up today and try FeedPress for a 14-day trial, no contracts or commitments. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year. That's promo code COVERED, COVERED. Our thanks to FeedPress for sponsoring this episode of Covered. Growing up, was there a writer who influenced you into doing what you do now?
I had, and I'm not sure at what age, actually, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. I read it probably the age 11 and fell so in love with it. And I've reread it a few times, you know, at different periods of my life. And each time I've fallen in love with it in different ways. So that is a very important book to me. And her writing, you know, I think just really stayed with me. And so it's been really a thrill to have the book compared to A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. But Flannery O'Connor, I'd say, is a writer who really, really I just fell in love with. But that was probably a bit later. I have a feeling I didn't really start to read her until college. But, you know, I've really studied her. And I think that might be, you know, I've been surprised the book keeps getting called Southern Literature, which I figured was because it was, you know, Pennsylvania isn't typically considered Appalachian. You know, people are usually calling Appalachia below the Mason-Dixon. So I was also very moved to have the book included in this, you know, get this Appalachian award. But I think that that kind of Southern voice, I think, probably comes from my love of Flannery O'Connor.
Is there a character from another book that you read that you wish you had created?
Oh, my goodness. I'm sure there is. That is such a good question. I mean, I certainly do wish I had created Francie from A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, you know, and I think I was very much thinking of her as I was writing Bridget. And, you know, I do hope that some of her wisdom, you know, came across into Bridget. But that is certainly someone, you know, that's a book I wish I'd written, and that's certainly a character I wish I had created.
What's the writing process for you like, you know, from a technical perspective? How do you get the job done?
At this, you know, now that I have a child, things have certainly changed drastically. So now I just write whenever I possibly can. And I try and make sure that I always have different types of writing things that I need to do. So depending on how tired I am or how much time I have or what, you know, whether I just have my phone or I just have paper, that I'm always able to get something done, you know, with my time. So that now that I have so much social media and publicity to do, there's always tasks that need to be done with that. You know, then I'll think even while I'm driving, hey, this is just time. Either I could be listening to a book or I could be planning a section, you know, of a new book. So I always try and just have a number of different tasks in my mind to say, you know, let me try and accomplish these. And then all the time I'm trying to get those things done, you know, and that's a challenge then, because of course you also want to be in the moment. And when you're with, especially family, you know, and friends, that you're really with them and not just thinking about other things. But I think that is how I manage to accomplish the amount I do accomplish, is because I constantly have things that it's like, okay, now I could get this done. Now I could get that done, you know, and then I'm always looking to just try and get chunks of time where I can really just sit and write. But those can be very hard to come by.
When you're writing, do you have anybody who reads your work before you're finished, or maybe after you finish a first draft or a first pass?
My mother is always the person, you know, who's my first reader. And she's the person, actually, I'll always talk out, you know, but now I try really hard to have a basic plot before I start writing. And I find that to be a big time saver. And she has helped me tremendously with The Hollow Ground and with everything I've ever written, where, you know, just planning things out, plot twists especially. But she also always reads the early drafts. And I'm working on a new novel right now, and I'm getting ready to print out, you know, a copy for her to look at, because she's my go-to reader on everything.
I've always been told, you know, don't let your mother read it. Don't let your spouse read it.
You know, it depends what it's about too. You know, I mean, this is all stuff I'm very comfortable having my mother read, you know, but that could be depending on your relationship with your mother and what the material is. You know, what's nice too with this, like with The Hollow Ground and with my new book, is it's not memoir, you know, being disguised as fiction. You know, these are stories that are really just, you know, coming from imagination and from people I've known, you know, but it's not me. And I found that to be very empowering with my writing. You know, I think I do better with my writing when it's not based on me.
When you write, do you say you have a plot in mind? Do you outline first, or do you pants it the whole way?
Yeah, that's what I've learned to do. That's the first, with the Hollow Ground, that is the first novel that I really had a full outline for before I started writing. And I found that to be very advantageous. And actually with the Hollow Ground, once I had to throw out my initial draft because I found out about the Carbondale fire and knew I, you know, needed and should tell that story, that actually helped me outline that book, because then I was outlining the dig out of that fire and matching the family story, you know, to the progression of the dig out of that fire. And so it really helped me structure the book. But with this new book too, I thought I see that it's a big time saver to first have at least the main parts of the plot worked out, and especially at least have a sense of the journey you want that main character, you know, where you want that main character ending up. So at least it's driving towards that point. But that, you know, I wish if I could have a really thorough outline before I start writing, because I think it would help me that much more. And that is what I'm aiming. I hope, you know, one day I am able to do that with a book. You know, mostly it's a pretty loose outline and I still wind up doing a lot of revision.
You said that you have several. So this is your fourth or arguably fifth novel that you've written, but you have others that haven't been published. Are there any plans to get those published?
You know, that's something I think about. You know, I need to revisit them. Right now, I'm more excited. I have this new book I'm doing, and I'm very excited about that. So I do want to just finish that one off. You know, and then we'll see. Then I'll start looking back at those others. You know, there's a part of me that just doesn't want to look back at them. But of course, you know, there they are, whole book, you know. It would be nice to look back at them. So, you know, right now there isn't a plan, but I do think eventually I will go to look back at them.
Yeah, I agree. Looking back at the first one I ever wrote, it's sort of like, this is bad, you should burn it. But at the same time, it's cool. It's cool to see that journey. You know, the writing. Yeah. I can definitely say that my writing, while I may not think it's good at all, it's definitely better than the first thing I ever wrote from start to finish. So it's
thank God for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the wonderful thing about writing too. You know, I do adjunct teach writing and tutor writing, and that's, you know, what I always am telling students is, you know, that's the wonderful thing about writing. I mean, you keep working at it and you keep getting better. It's not like you ever hit a time where it's like, okay, this is it. You know, I'm at my best.
I joke about the self-doubt, but is that something you struggle with? Do you struggle with when you're writing a book or if you're working on a short story, do you say to yourself, this is terrible, no one's ever going to read this?
It depends on my mood. I have swings where it's like, oh, I'm so on. This is so good. I'm so right on the money with this. And then other points where whatever, something's happened where I'm just feeling insecure. And then everything I'm writing, it's just like, oh, this is terrible. This is no good. And, you know, it's really hard to get through those periods. And you almost wonder if you should just stop writing at that point, you know, when you're questioning everything, you know. Or is it better to just keep writing? I don't know. You know, and it probably depends just on that moment. You know, I don't know that there's a specific answer to that for anyone, you know?
My belief is just write through it and hopefully you pick up a little more and you get a little better each time.
Yeah.
What's the worst question, in your opinion, to ask a writer? And if I've asked it, please don't tell me.
It's not that it's the worst question. The hardest one for me to answer is people will ask, you know, what actor do I want to have act this or that? And it's not that it's a, you know, that's a terrible question to ask. It's kind of a fun question to ask. But I love watching movies, but I'm not one of those people who I follow the actors' names and everything. It's like, oh, you know, this person who did this part in that movie, but I have no idea what the actor's name is. And so that I struggle with those kind of questions because then I'm struggling to try and find the names of these actors and actresses. And that's the only reason that's a hard question for me.
Natalie, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. This has been great.
Thanks so much for having me, Harry. I really enjoyed it.
It's been my pleasure. And actually, I do have one final question.
Okay.
What do you want people to take away with them at the end of The Hollow Ground?
Yeah, for me, it's really a story. It's a hero's journey. It's this young girl's hero journey. And in terms, it's not your classic hero journey. In this case, her journey is that she learns to accept and forgive and let go of her parents' weaknesses. And her parents' weaknesses are pretty, you know, major ones. And to me, that is just so admirable. And there's very few people I've met who are able to do that, but I have met a few. And those are the people I was thinking of as I wrote this. And that, to me, is truly heroic. And I really admire that girl for that. And that's the thing I was really trying to get at with the book. And in terms of the grandmother, too, she is someone who also has some surprisingly, you know, redeeming qualities. And she's actually, the grandmother is actually my favorite character. So it's that journey with those two characters that's the thing, is the thing I really want people to come away with.
The grandmother is definitely someone who I went in not liking at all. And the more I see her interact with her friend, Mrs. Schwackhammer, and with Bridget, and even Dolores, Bridget's mother, I see these little glimmers of light in her, you know, buried deep underneath. And I start to feel a little more affection for her as the book goes on. So
I'm glad to hear it. I love her.
Where can people find you?
Yeah, I have my website that has a lot of information on it, including contact information and the educator's guide and book club questions and photos of the Carbondale dig out. And that is natalieharnett.com. And Harnett is spelled H-A-R-N-E-T-T. You know, and the book's on sale at Amazon and right now in all of the major bookstores. But you can always ask if the bookstore doesn't have it. You can always ask for it.
Excellent. Thank you again so much for coming on. This has been Covered with special guest Natalie Harnett. Her book, The Hollow Ground, is available in paperback from St. Martin's Press. Thanks for listening. And if you haven't already, please drop us a review in iTunes. That's the best way for other book lovers to find our show. We also have a Patreon page at patreon.com/covered so fans can contribute to the podcast's production. We have some great perks lined up for our patrons, so please consider supporting Covered with any amount you can. And thank you again to Feed Press and Knocked Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book until it's covered.